This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, I got to have a wide-ranging conversation with Emily Bazelon. We talked about two big deportation cases. And we also talked about the power of President Trump and really any president to implement funding freezes. Big legal issues that are almost certain to make their way to the Supreme Court. As many of you already know, Emily is a senior research scholar in law and the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School. She's also a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and author of two national bestsellers. First, Charge: The Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. And second, Sticks and Stones: Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She also, as many of you know, co-hosts the popular podcast, The Slate Political Gabfest. Before joining the New York Times, Emily worked for 9 years as a senior editor at Slate. She has been a Soros Media Fellow, an editor and writer at Legal Affairs Magazine, and a law clerk on the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. She was a frequent guest on the Colbert Report, and she also is a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I learned a lot, and it gave me a lot to think about as we move forward. Emily, I'm such a fan of your work. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for passing judgment with us.
I'm so glad to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
So we are recording this conversation on April 14th, and there is, as always, breaking legal news. And I'd like to talk about a number of the different deportation cases and immigration cases, and then focus on your excellent piece around the Impoundment Act. There are so many other things that we could talk to you about. But the news of the day, I think today, is what is happening to Mr. Obrega-Garcia. Of course, he was mistakenly deported from our country. There has been a good deal of legal wrangling. The district court essentially ordered that the federal government facilitate and effectuate his return to the U.S. The case went up to the Supreme Court. As I read it, and I would love your take on it, the Supreme Court basically said, yes, you federal government need to facilitate his return to the U.S. We'd like more clarification about what the word effectuate means. And that essentially brings us, I think, to today and an Oval Office meeting between President Trump and the president of El Salvador, where it sounded like there were no plans to facilitate, effectuate, or anything else, the return of Mr. Obrega-Garcia. So could you help us understand where we are legally right now? And then I'll ask you to look forward.
Yeah, sure. I mean, where we are legally is that the Trump administration is disobeying a court order from Judge Paul Zinnes in Maryland and claiming that it's within the bounds of the Supreme Court's opinion following up on Judge Zinnes. And I think that's like the big next question, is what the Supreme Court is going to think about this dynamic. Because, you know, what's happened is that, I mean, I read the Supreme Court's decision last week the way you do. They affirmed Judge Zinnes saying that the Trump administration should facilitate this return and said that the government should be prepared to share what information it can about the steps it's taking to bring about this return. And then the government came into court and said, no, we're not going to really tell you anything. We don't think we have to take any steps. We think this is entirely within the power of the president and that there should be no review from courts at all on these questions. That seems very much at odds with the spirit, if not the letter, of the Supreme Court's ruling. And so now we seem to be kind of veering towards some kind of showdown. And it's a little hard to understand. I mean, to take a step back, the government has confessed error here. They have said this man was wrongfully deported. Now they're making all kinds of unproven claims about him being dangerous, but they have literally not proved a single thing about him. And bringing back one person who has been sentenced to an indefinite period, it seems, in this notorious El Salvadorian prison just is very much at odds with American constitutional law and, you know, rule of law as we've known it in the United States.
So that's really helpful. I'd like to dig in on one thing that you talked about. And of course, this is our endless question of whether or not the U.S. government is openly defying court orders, or if they're saying some version of, well, we actually don't need to comply, or I understand your order to be narrower or broader than it is. And I think my question with respect to this case is there any basis for what the federal government is arguing in the sense of the Supreme Court did have some language asking for clarification on the issue of what effectuate means and basically make sure that district court, what you're doing doesn't tread on the lane of the executive branch. And then the district court said, okay, give me an update. And I heard the federal government say, maybe not, we won't, but we can't at this moment. Or is that just giving the federal government too much benefit of the doubt here?
No, I think that everything you said is true, and it's important to recognize that. There was a way to read some of the lack of clarity in the Supreme Court's decision last week in exactly the way you're talking about. You know, the justices kind of opened the door to this kind of interpretation, but I think it's pretty clear that it's all a big pretext, right? I mean, just to sort of get down to the fundamentals here, our government is claiming there is nothing they can do to bring back someone they wrongfully sent to a tiny country that they have a lot of power over when in fact they are paying for this person to be in prison there. And the head of this country is showing up today meeting with President Trump. So there, it's just sort of a farce, the idea that there's nothing they could do. Of course they could bring him back if they wanted to. And I think it's also clear from the spirit, if not the like absolute letter of the Supreme Court's ruling, that that was what the court had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly what Judge Zinnes has ordered, right, in clarifying her order after the Supreme Court ruled.
It seems to me that this issue of has the federal government proven anything here does lead us a little bit into the Khalil discussion, which I want to get to in a minute, about basically whether or not the federal government has to prove up reasons to deport people, or if this really is a matter of their purview. But before we get there, I did want to drill down on this question of jurisdiction for a minute, because I think you're, of course, right to say the president of El Salvador is in the Oval Office with the president of the United States, and it seems to me that they could come to a political resolution. Is there anything to the argument that federal judges actually don't have the power to force that political resolution?
I mean, in theory, I think yes. In practice, right, like you could imagine a zone that the courts would say, this is the foreign relations power, the diplomatic powers of the executive, and we're not going to enter that zone. This could be sensitive. It could involve information we don't have or know about. We're going to defer to the president here. But I don't think we have a lot of examples in the case law, in Supreme Court precedent, that that is how it has worked in the past. I mean, it has not been a lot of cases that the government has been citing in support of that position, right? And in fact, in the past, this has happened before. We have wrongfully, accidentally removed people to other countries before, and we have tried to get them back before. And it has not always gone perfectly or smoothly, but the notion that this is like some crazy idea that you go and you get back someone you sent away in error, that is just not, it's totally at odds with how things have worked in the past, as I understand it.
Well, that's, I think, brings us to, as I said, our next topic. And I could talk to you about Obrega-Garcia for much longer, but I really want to get your thoughts also on Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil. And he, of course, was a legal permanent resident. He was deported from this country. And there was recently an immigration judge who, I understand, looked at the Immigration and Nationality Act and looked at certain language that I view as a pretty broad grant of authority to the Secretary of State, and said essentially, well, the Secretary of State has made a determination that Mr. Khalil staying in the country was, I think the language is, potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. And I read the immigration judge as saying, I don't have the power to second guess that call. Is that your reading of that particular case? Again, I want to talk to you about the New Jersey federal case, but just the immigration decision. I didn't read that as, yes, federal government, I agree with you, and I think you prove that he does, in fact, pose some potential adverse consequence, but I don't have the power to weigh in here.
Totally agree with you. You know, immigration judges work for the executive branch. They can also be fired by the executive branch. And this judge was very explicit that she was just looking at the words in front of her from the law you just read, which is a very broad grant of power to the Secretary of State, and saying, I'm out. There are important underlying constitutional and legal questions here, but that's for the federal courts to decide. And I'm just looking at this law and what the government has claimed, and that's enough for this particular proceeding.
And this also seems to bring up the idea that we were talking about before, where I think there's been historic practice, and then there's been the current practice, which maybe does not follow the way we previously acted. My view of a lot of these laws on the books, both inside of the area of immigration and outside, is that we actually have a lot of legislation that provides broad grants of authority to the executive, but we haven't had members of the executive branch use those grants of power in this way. Is this, in your view, one example of the law says what it says, it provides a huge amount of discretion, but we just haven't used it before? Are there other examples you think about?
Well, first of all, I think that you're right. And when the reporting started about this case, it often stories noted, well, this is an obscure law. And what they meant was, like, nobody had dusted it off the shelf and used it in the way that our current Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is using it on behalf of the Trump administration. But it is still on the books, and it is a very broad grant, and it doesn't really matter whether it's obscure or not, right? Like, that's what it says. And there are absolutely other examples of this. You know, the Insurrection Act comes to mind. The Insurrection Act gives the president pretty broad authority to bring in the military on domestic soil. And whether that's wise to have on the books or not, it remains there. And we have counted on the kind of thoughtful, good faith of presidents not to overuse that. In fact, they have been extremely sparing in their use of it. But that doesn't mean that that is necessarily going to continue with our current administration.
I mean, I can think back to a number of so-called zombie laws where I think we're going to have a lesson in the fact that if a law is still on the books, just because it wasn't used in a certain way before, doesn't mean that it won't be here. Now, I did kind of promise and preview that this isn't the only legal proceeding regarding Mr. Khalil. There is a separate New Jersey federal case that's ongoing. And my understanding is that in that case, there's a different question that involves not specifically the language of the statute we've been talking about and the grant of authority to the Secretary of State, but whether perhaps using the statute in the way it's been used gives rise to First Amendment and speech and due process questions. In my understanding, I'm hoping you can explain this a bit more, is the idea that Mr. Khalil was targeted based on the substance of his speech, based on his viewpoint, based on what he said, and that therefore, while there may be the power to deport, you cannot use the statute in this way, meaning you can't use it based on we don't like what you said and therefore you should leave the country. Is that essentially what's going on in the proceedings in New Jersey?
Yes, I think that's right. And the kind of underlying question here is whether this person's constitutional rights, First Amendment rights, rights to due process, override the broad grant of authority in this statute, right? In other words, if the only evidence the government has presented for the Secretary of State's conclusion that Khalil poses a danger is his speech. Essentially, he was protesting at Columbia and Barnard in favor of rights of Palestinians. Well, that's protected. And in United States law, we have a great deal of protection to free speech rights. We really kind of see being able to express yourself freely as fundamental to what it means to be in the United States. And so what the Trump administration is claiming is that because Khalil was not a U.S. citizen, he doesn't have the same First Amendment rights as U.S. citizens. And I, you know, hate to say, I don't think the Supreme Court has absolutely clearly said that visa holders and longtime permanent residents do have the same rights, but certainly that is the kind of set of American principles that we've all lived under and assumed. And there's plenty of reason to think that they absolutely should apply to Khalil's speech here. So again, it's somewhat of an unresolved legal question, but as a matter of principle and of American values, it seems quite clear.
It does seem in so many ways we're living through a stress test of how much are our assumptions and our historical practice going to hold up when we look at things like specific grants of authority, broad grants of authority, and maybe areas where the Constitution is not quite clear. And I do think that brings us to our last topic, which is the fine piece you wrote in the New York Times back in February about the Impoundment Act, and specifically examining the question of President Trump's power to cut off, determine, have discretion over, you know, choose your language, federal funding. So could you talk to us a little bit about the actions that President Trump took that gave rise to the Impoundment Act questions? I know this was a few months ago, which in the legal news now feels longer ago than it actually was. But this is a really important case about the separation of powers, the power of the Supreme Court. So what did President do that led to this particular challenge?
Right. So back when the term started, there were very quickly executive orders that were shutting down agencies and canceling grants and contracts that had already been awarded. And this was without any review by the administrative agencies. In other words, it wasn't about how to spend the money that Congress had appropriated. It was about whether to spend it at all. And this is where the Impoundment Act comes in, and also the Constitution more fundamentally, because the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse, right? The power to decide how to spend money. And so initially, the questions about these frozen grants and canceled contracts were all about, well, can the president just unilaterally come in and decide not to spend money that Congress has authorized the executive to spend? And I think the answer to that is pretty clearly no. And the courts were ruling in that manner about this question of the president's power to impound.
Now, we're talking about the Impoundment Act and also talking about the Constitution. And I think this might be confusing to people because obviously we're talking about a statute, but we're also talking about the fundamental idea that the federal government, and particularly Congress, can only act when there's something in the Constitution that gives it the power to act. And the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse. So could you highlight for us whether or not you actually maybe need the Impoundment Act in order to say that Trump perhaps does not have the power to do what he's doing? Or is this really a constitutional concern?
I don't think you do need the Impoundment Act, but the Impoundment Act is like the cherry on top because it shows that Congress acted to protect its power of the purse, right? So you have the Constitution and the division of power that grants Congress the power of the purse that we've been talking about. Presidents generally respected that line, not perfectly, but generally. Then you get up to Richard Nixon, and he had this big confrontation with Congress. He impounded billions of dollars that had already been appropriated that was supposed to be going to fight pollution. And in 1974, Congress passed the Impoundment Control Act, which said, hey, no more impoundments of funds we have authorized by the president, except for a few narrow exceptions. And so that limit on presidential authority, I think, lines up and kind of underscores the limit that the Constitution itself sets.
I read it as belt and suspenders. And I know that there's been some question when this case continues to work its way up the system. So, Emily, my understanding is that this is a little bit of a belt and suspenders approach. Do we know if the Trump administration plans to say that the Impoundment Act itself violates the Constitution because it treads on the executive's power?
I think they were flirting with that idea, but we haven't seen a kind of full-on set of arguments that have gone up the line to the appellate courts making that argument. Instead, they kind of semi-retreated to the position that the administrative agencies had a lot of discretion to change and cancel a lot of ongoing or forthcoming grants and contracts. And on that ground, they are on more solid footing, and they've been winning some of those actions in court. And so that has kind of, at least for now, put a direct challenge to the Impoundment Control Act of 1974 kind of on a back burner. But that doesn't mean they won't revisit it.
Right. I think my last question, Emily, we've covered a lot of ground. We've covered big immigration cases. I know you have another article coming out about the Alien Enemies Act. I'd like to end, only for the sake of time, with a question that I think I've gotten every day since January 20th, which is some version of, can you help us think through what happens if the executive branch does, in fact, defy a Supreme Court order? So I'm stripping out lower court order, I'm stripping out appellate court order, just the Supreme Court, and I'm stripping out any nuance about what we talked about before. Well, is there some argument that maybe they're not saying I won't comply? They're saying we are complying, we're just doing it slowly. It is open defiance. Can you walk us through what happens after that?
Well, I mean, then we will be in the kind of most clear form of a constitutional crisis. I think some of the other more interim erosion of following orders that you were talking about could also count as a constitutional crisis. And I'm sort of at this point, I don't want to put too much weight on the idea that, like, it has to come to this particular head for us to be in a very bad place for constitutional law and separation of powers in America, right? Like, I feel like this is the sort of Hollywood version of the crisis. And there are other versions that are also a real problem. But if this happens, then we're going to be left with a political question about how Americans respond, because the Supreme Court has no army of its own. The U.S. Marshal Service, which enforces court orders, is part of the executive branch. So if the executive branch and the president truly say, no, I'm not going to do this, then there is no remedy other than a political remedy. The courts are the least dangerous branch. They are supposed to be a co-equal branch. And since Marbury versus Madison in 1803, they have had the power to say what the law is. And that independence of the courts and that power of judicial review has been essential to the functioning of our democracy and the protecting of people's rights. But it is contingent on our political system protecting it. And so that is going to be in the hands of Americans.
I think we're realizing what a trust exercise our Constitution actually is. Emily, thank you so much for your time. We hit so many topics quickly, and as always, you brought such clarity to them, and I'm really grateful.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for your great questions, and you know a ton about this, which makes it fun for me.